My name is John, and my name is John, and we ain't turning right all podcast long. Whoa, we're going left and straight. Whoa, the podcast is great. Whoa, cruising around LA, picking up friends on the way. Well, John is my friend, and now you are my friend, and we're doing it up, and then we do it all again. Whoa, two Johns don't make a right.
Ooh. Thank you, sir.
Oh, hell yeah.
Nice place. I love this neighborhood.
Thank you. It's been a long time, 15 years almost.
You've been here 15 years.
Not what? In this house, but this neighborhood.
Do you call this Los Feliz or Beechwood?
Here you go.
Thank you, sir.
What do you call it?
I think it's technically Los Feliz.
Okay.
I mean, technically Hollywood, so...
Yeah.
Los Feliz starts, like, on Ferndale.
Okay.
Which is just the next major street that way.
We don't want to dox anybody here.
I do. I want to dox me. See if anyone cares.
Dox me! We got... Oh, shit, is that a military guy? What's going on?
That's my neighbor, Sean. He's Republican, but very kind, and he does not like Trump.
Was he in the military?
Yes.
Right, okay. So he's not cosplaying Stealing Valor.
No.
From the Marine Corps, which would be a punishable offense, punishable by jail.
Punishable by us.
Punishable by us, mocking him.
He's getting the business card from a detail guy.
Yeah.
Mobile detail guy. Do you know who these people are, too?
I do not.
That guy created the Brady Bunch. Sherwood Schwartz.
It was an elderly gentleman, so he could have.
Ladies and gentlemen, here we are again in the fart van. It's John and John. Ladies and gentlemen, I don't know if you're aware of this, John S., Tall John. People have been talking about the podcast. People are talking about this. They're telling each other about it, and they're talking about it.
So you say...
Yeah, and people are saying that we are the Kwisatz Haderach of podcasting. Only, we're not a sexy young messiah whose name is a killing word. We're two sexy young Gaias who drive around Hollywood flipping assholes the bird. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Two Johns Don't Make a Right. We're driving around, and we are not turning right. It's Two Johns Don't Make a Right. We're turning left only. Ladies and gentlemen, today, we got very special guest, Joe Wong.
Woo!
Yes.
Thank you.
Musician, drummer, musician, composer as well, rock and roll singer, Joe Wong. Ladies and gentlemen.
Did you go see the Kwisatz Haderach the other day, John?
I saw it. I saw Dune 2 on Friday night, or Thursday, last Thursday on opening night at the Vista.
And that was the opening night, the official opening of the theater, huh?
It wasn't the opening of the Vista. They opened it on, like a month ago or 2 months ago or something.
Was that your first time since they reopened it?
It was, yeah.
How was it?
Incredible.
How were the seats?
Here's the thing. The popcorn. Tarantino makes it 1974, or whenever he felt the most magically inclined towards movies, I'm sure. So it's like the popcorn has real butter on it that tastes good and doesn't make you feel like shit.
Yeah.
And the Coke is like Coke from the 70s. Like
with sugar.
With sugar, but like made in the same way, with the same ice.
Like Mexican Coke?
I think it's just with real sugar, so it would be probably Mexican Coke.
That's
now.
That's great.
And then, you know, the theater's, like, all the same, but the trailers are not, like, it's two Looney Tunes cartoons. So they played, like, OG Looney Tunes cartoons, and then all the trailers are, like, a trailer from 1950 of, like, part melted film of Alice in Wonderland, like, the original, and then, like, a trailer for, like, just trailers for, like amazing trailers from Tarantino's collection. So it's really good. They did a great job. He should take over, I think, every theater. We've been talking about that.
Arclight. He needs to take over the Arclight.
Yeah, I mean, that might be more than even he can bite off. But yeah. Tell me more about the seats, John.
The seats are far apart. Yeah, so you have the...
Really? Is it like Alamo Drafthouse style?
No. It's not Alamo Drafthouse because you're not, like, getting food.
Right.
Which I don't really like the waiter coming around. Like,
it is distracting.
The waiter's in the corner of your eye. You're trying to buy into, like, fucking the Quizzarts Haderach riding a sandworm. No. No thanks. But this is just like, yeah, it's just normal theater. And then they have Pam's Coffee, which we went to with Ben Rogers on the last podcast, where it's like Tarantino has a screening room for like six people. Anyway, it's cool. Joe, I just saw you live at the Hollywood Cemetery Mausoleum or whatever.
Masonic
Lodge, rather. And it was just a fucking amazing show, man.
Thank you so much.
Gigantic show. Sold out. Amazing. You're playing your new stuff, your old stuff. The musicians on stage, unbelievable. We had Mary Timoney from X-Hex. And from Mary Timoney, she just put a record out. We had fucking the drummer of Pearl Jam, Matt Cameron, on stage. We had Mark Giuliana, the best drummer in the world, maybe? Not Giuliani, right?
Giuliana.
Shout out to Mark Giuliana. Everyone follow him on Instagram. He's one of these polyrhythmic wizards that would blow your mind. How did you feel about that show, Joe? It was so dope.
It was great. Yeah, I think you were at the first time I played there at the end of 2019, which was before I put out my first solo album. And
Night Creatures.
And that was supposed to be kind of like a proof of concept. We were going to tour all through 2020 and 2021, which all got canceled. It was really awesome. At some point, I just decided to make another album, and it was really great to play again.
Yeah, so you had two harp players on stage, Mary Lattimore.
And Shelley Bergen, yeah.
Shelley Bergen, amazing. Wow. Two harps.
I basically just invited anybody that I'd worked with on the album to come be part of the release party, and I didn't actually expect everyone to say yes, but that was actually the most people that have ever been on stage there, they told us.
Wow. Really? Because it was like, would you call it orchestral?
Yeah,
it's
sure.
Orchestral. You got a harp on stage, it's orchestral.
There were two harps. There were like 22 people on stage at some point.
Phil Collins, remember? Two harps living in just one mind.
22 people on stage?
Yeah.
That's like Polyphonic Spree stuff,
I guess.
Dude. Yeah, man. You should start a cult with that thing.
I would love to.
Start wearing robes.
I have a medallion. I mean, isn't that enough?
You're halfway there.
That's right. You got a cool-ass medallion.
I have a very rare record that was made by a guy called Father Yod of the Source family.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Father Yod.
I think there are only 500 copies, and it's maybe one of the rarest records I own, but on the back, there's a baby wearing a medallion.
Wow. Oh, wow. Yeah, really the babies good. Were little pimps back then.
Mm-hmm.
The Source family is great. There's a great documentary I saw on them.
Yes, Jody Wiley made it. It's great.
Yeah, just so great, and they were like the L.A. cult. I think there's a larger story to be told, I think, in general, about westward expansion in America and how it's 100% cults.
Cult-driven, yeah,
like,
the Mormons.
It's crazy.
Yeah, sure.
The Mormons are just, like, a successful cult. Like, you know, like, and their cult-ish nature is, like, they're branching off into, like, 40 other kind of sects of Mormonism.
Pilgrims were kind of in a cult, too, right? Like, all of the Europeans that came over here were religiously motivated at first, it would seem.
Yeah,
I'm in a woke cult, according to Twitter.
You're in a woke cult?
Yeah.
Is that W-O-K-E?
That's right.
What's so woke about it?
What's it called?
Not liking Trump is all the only qualification you need to be a part of the woke cult.
I don't think that makes you woke, not like Trump.
Oh, I'm being a little sarcastic. It's just, you know, everyone's being labeled into a cult these days.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. No. Totally.
Yes. I don't really think I'm in a cult.
I had a chicken fall into my yard. I don't know. Did I talk about this? A chicken landed in my fucking yard. I was thinking, like, maybe he's in a yoke cult.
Oh.
Oh, boy. Okay, well.
I'm just going to turn right up here.
No, don't turn right, because then the podcast's over. Ladies and gentlemen, we're driving down, what is this, Western, or?
It's a woke joke.
Canyon?
It's a woke joke. We're on Bronson, and we're turning left on Santa Monica.
fuck Donald Trump, first of all. I mean...
Whoa, he might listen to this.
Whoa, hold on. And if you're listening, Donald, we're kidding. We love you, man. Please take over our country and do whatever the fuck you want. Turn us into Moldova.
Back to the source. I used to eat at that restaurant all the time in the 90s. I
had Are you serious?
I'm very serious.
Whoa!
I had no clue it was a cult at the time.
Was it just, still operated by the same people?
Yeah, it was like, but it was like branded. It was like, oh, this is like a health food restaurant. And you know who was there every fucking weekend was Fabio.
Oh, really? My God.
Yeah. But when I first moved to L.A., I joined a gym, like, on a trial membership, and I saw Fabio. And,
yeah. You know you're in the right place if you're in the same place as Fabio.
Dude, I worked with Fabio.
You made all the right choices.
I made a Funnier Die video.
You
did.
You made a best friend video.
Called about the goose? Fabio is my imaginary friend.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that.
And and I hung out with him for the whole day. What a nice guy. And at one point in the video, we had a bunch of ladies and in the video in a pool with Fabio, and I gotta say, whatever that guy's got going on is real, because those ladies, it was like insane. They could not, I was like, well, of course Fabio's hot, but he's not gonna like get actively hit on by every woman at this thing. And it was like, no, he is. They are all like,
yeah,
they're all over this dude. And
he's like a masculine Chaz Dean.
Yeah, exactly. He's Chaz Dean, alt universe, yin yang Chaz Dean. But these girls were on him in a way. And he's like a big horse man. He's like, you know, a sexy horse. He's an Italian prince, and he's from Italian royalty. And I remember it being like, Fabio, what are you doing after we shoot this dumb comedy video? And he was like, oh, I'm going to Amalfi Coast to just ride motorcycles with my friends. I was like, oh, it's pretty good, man. Pretty good.
You made one of those videos with Kenny G, too. And there were girls and ladies in that. Did Kenny G have the same kind of charisma?
You know what? I'll say this. Yes, he was charismatic. Kenny G's a charismatic dude, and I think part of it is, like, he's just so intensely wealthy that there's something about it that's like, what kind of guy is intensely... I think he's a nerd kind of guy. Like, even he would say, like, you know, I'm a nerd, but I played with Miles Davis. You know, like, he's played with everybody, and he's kind of amazing. And he was like, I practice 3.5 hours every morning. I was like, wow, that's pretty fucking intense.
That's too much. He's already made it. He can scale that down to 45 minutes.
Yeah, and I asked him about it. I was like, what kind of music are you into playing? He's like, you know, I just don't like music. I was like, do you like jazz? He was like, nah, I just don't like it. You know what? I really like practicing. And I was like, wow, you just like practicing. That's so amazing.
He just plays Baker Street every morning for 3.5 hours.
Just wails on Baker Street.
Who's the analog in the comedy world?
Who's the analog?
Someone that just works really hard and found a way to do it.
Oh, I think it's
but doesn't
who doesn't care
like,
about comedy?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. Jay Leno? I don't know. I don't think he became a person that like tells jokes for a living, but I don't think he's interested necessarily in comedy. I think he's interested in himself being famous.
That like using comedy as a vehicle for success.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, he's a weirdo, Jay Leno. But
it's a good question, because I think there are comedians who are doing comedy to get to the next thing, whether it be acting or whatever they want to do.
Well, there's always been comics who are like, I'm a better actor, but I'm meeting people and stuff. Like Michael Keaton. Like Michael Keaton used to, you know, do the improv and stuff.
Did he?
And then he was like, I'm not really a good comedian, but, you know, I'm a...
Well, watch this. Watch this acting I'm about to
watch do. Watch this. Beetlejuice. Say it one more time. And now we got Beetlejuice coming out.
Right.
Richard Belzer was he's like a Michael Keaton kind of guy, right? He was a comic and then everybody
yes.
knows him as the Law and Order guy.
But I feel like Belzer was more of a comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was definitely doing comedy, I feel like, throughout the 80s. Like, I feel like Michael Keaton was the kind of guy who was like, I stopped. Like, he's not doing, like, live stand-up. Like,
right.
I feel like Belzer was, like, weirdly on NYPD, or you know, he got that Law and Order gig, and he was in movies, too, like, R.I.P. Richard Lewis, who just passed away. Mm. I was watching a movie that Belzer was in, and that dude could not be more just making fun of the movie as he's acting in it. Just, like, seems like a funny asshole dude. I've met him once, Belzer, because he was judging a sketch comedy competition in New York, and the judges were an NYPD fireman who survived 9/11, a clown, this woman clown, and this is before clowns were cool, way before, and Richard Belzer. And I was just like, what is Belzer doing here? And we lost to a sketch comedy group that did a sketch called Sitting on a Bear, where they sang the song Living on a Prayer, but they had one of their guys in their group dressed up as a bear. And they said, sitting on a bear.
No shame in losing to the best.
Yeah, I mean, no shame in losing to sitting on a bear, man.
Comedy really is a meritocracy, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like the cream rises to the top. And when Belzer's there, along with a 9/11 fireman, who 8 years after 9/11 was like, I judge this comedy good. So that's cool.
You've always had it out for the first responders.
I have, yeah. I'm like...
It's because you're in that woke cult.
Yeah.
Well, the first responders get it, you know, they get it the worst because they really have to respond. The second responders, that's where it's at because you can relax. You still get credit.
Joe, I just want to throw out to you real quick, if you desire anything, a coffee, a froyo, say something. Maybe we pass something and we can stop.
Okay.
A froyo, el pollo, loco.
How are you guys feeling? I could always have more coffee, but...
Yeah, well, any place you want to stop. We always stop on this.
Okay.
Well, we always offer to stop.
We always offer to stop if you want.
How often do people take you up on that offer?
80%?
Good 80% of the time.
Zach Krager was just like...
Now we're driving by the old Virgil where they used to have the hot tub comedy show.
Yeah, this is the old home of Kurt and Brown Kristen. Oler, Kristen Shaw.
Is it shuttered?
No. The Virgil's still open. It's just a club, so it's like shuttered during the day.
Gotcha. It used to be the garage.
I don't remember that.
How long have you lived here?
12 years.
Okay.
So when I moved here was right around when Kurt and Kristen moved out.
Started. Gotcha.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it was the garage, and I was in a shitty band in the 90s called Perfume.
What?
Yeah.
Have you talked about this?
That's not a great name. Wait, that's a great name for a band.
I played bass.
Oh, my God.
My friend Max Ween started the band, and he named it Perfume because it was Kurt Cobain's favorite book.
Mm.
And, you know, it was the 90s, so everyone was trying to sound like Kurt Cobain. We didn't do a good job of accomplishing that, but we tried, and it was fun playing out, but we objectively weren't, you know, good musicians.
Did you feel like...
Is that
like,
something you can measure objectively?
Yeah. I think, that guy knows how to play his instrument. Oh, that
like
guy
a, like Kenny
nobody.
G, for example. Exactly. He practices 3 hours a day.
Yes.
Yeah, nobody's going to say about Kenny G, that guy can't play. You can still
Some
say
Some people say it about it. Jazz musicians do say it about him.
Now you can't objectively say someone's bad or good, but you can objectively say he doesn't know how to play drums or he doesn't know how to play bass.
I would say jazz musicians feel about Kenny G the way a lot of comics might feel about Jay Leno, like younger comics.
Yeah, but Jay Leno's a little bit coming around, I feel like.
Yeah.
Because he's...
He should do this show.
He's a victim.
And he was really nice to you, John.
He was. I met him on a mountainside.
And people from his generation say he was incredible back in the 70s.
Well, that's what everyone says. And Letterman, like, back on the early Letterman, Letterman was like, had, you know, Jay Leno every night. Like, I got in a hole during the pandemic. I just watched every Jay Leno Letterman performance. I watched every Eddie Murphy, Johnny Carson. But, yeah, Leno, I mean, to us, it's like, sucks, but you know, he was like, he wore a motorcycle jacket and was very cool.
And he's from Boston.
Yeah, and he's like a working man kind of comedian. He's got like a I'm a working man kind of guy, you know, got a chip on his shoulder for all the cool kids, I'd say.
Yeah, and I think you've hammered on the right guy as far as the analog to Kenny G, because he did put in all this insane work, right? When he got the show, he would like fly to every affiliate and meet with them and stuff like that.
He's the guy that's like, and like David Letterman used to make fun of him for that, like mm-hmm. back when they had the rift.
You're trying too hard. Yeah.
Yeah. He'd be like, but all right, Jay, have a rift. You know, you got to watch losing your soul or whatever, like, you know, You gain the Tonight Show, but you lose your soul. At what price, Jay? He'd say stuff like that. Anyway, that was great. This is going
so
great.
So, where else did Perfume play? And how long were you together?
We were together, I would say, like 96, 97-ish.
Wow.
And
did you open for any bands that became big?
I don't think so. I still have the little cutouts from our, the LA Weekly, you know, when that was still a thing. And it was like, we played the Dragonfly, which was a, you know, a popular club at the time. Like, real bands would play there, not on the nights we did. And then our first gig was at the Anti-Club, which is a popular or famous place that's no longer in existence. Like, we were one of the... We may have been the reason they closed. It was like, oh, this is what's the future. Let's just shut it down.
Oh, no.
Jabberjaw? Did you do Jabberjaw?
Did not do Jabberjaw. We did Bordner's Bar a lot. They had a back patio where bands would play. And I liked that a lot. They would just, you know, give us, like, free drinks.
What are some... I'm taking a picture of L. Ron Hubbard Way, which we're on. We're in the heart of Scientology, Los Angeles. Right by Square One Cafe. Shout out to Square One.
John, that's where you and I first met.
Do we go to Square One?
Should we go there to get a coffee?
Our friend Sarah put us in touch there.
Yes. And we'll give a shout out to Sarah Kornbluth.
That's right.
Working at the Natural History Museum in New York. She's the bee expert. She took me and my friends, Nick and Brad, on a bee tour.
Is she the one who wrote that article about the cherry factory and the bees?
Oh, really?
I don't know.
No, but that's the kind of shit she works on, like bee stuff. Like the death of bees kind
of
thing.
Do you pause this or we take it in.
All this right, is a full.
Can you?
Did it not go? Well, see, if you do it and I do it, you got to just be... There you go. John's always trying to open the door while I'm opening the door, and it just doesn't work that way. It's got to be patient, John. I hope he hears this when the podcast comes out.
All right. Oh, there's a place next to it, too.
Let's do that. Look at us.
This is Vietnamese.
That's what you're doing.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
Cool. Can I get a Vietnamese iced coffee, please?
Certainly.
Awesome.
Is that for you?
May I please have a cold brew?
Yeah, same tab?
Yeah, same tab. Okay. These guys are going to be expensive.
We're going to expensive.
Yeah, we'll work it.
Also, a sparkling ginger limeade.
Yeah.
All right. This guy knows what's up.
I try.
Whoa, look at those Skittles. Those...
Do we get them?
Some sort of...
Vietnamese Skittles?
Vietnamese Skittles.
Let's get them.
Yeah, let's get them. Wow. Candy.
So who's the drummer you were saying is the best drummer?
Oh, he was saying Mark Giuliana.
From which band?
Mark kind of started as a jazz.
He's like the jazz drummer of the fucking
I'm born in 80, he is too. And of my generation, he's one of the more kind of known guys.
Gotcha.
But he kind of broke through into the rock world. He played on Bowie's last record, Black Star.
Do you want any room for oat milk?
Sure, yeah, thanks.
Played on Bowie's last album. That's amazing. Wow. And if you look at his...
a new level of awareness, but now he plays with St. Vincent, too.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
I'm bringing it up because I've always been under the impression... I'm a long time a fan of the Vandals, and I know those guys. Yeah. So, yeah, Josh is often regarded as the best drummer, but so is, like, Danny Carey.
It just depends on who you ask.
Right.
But like someone like Josh is impressive to me because he'll tour with Sting and Nine Inch Nails, and like he can play all the different genres.
Yeah.
And he hasn't aged in 30 years.
And he smokes still.
He smokes?
Yeah, maybe that's his key.
Maybe that's it.
I feel like some people just smoke.
I heard that keeps you young.
I feel like they smoke and it makes you look old, but it keeps you young. Yeah.
I'm working on a record now with a different artist that I'm producing, and Josh and Mark both played on it, so it was fun to watch their different approaches.
Oh, wow. Who's that?
I don't think I can stay on this.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Okay, wow.
It's Perfume. We're getting back together.
Yeah. Wait, what's the name of a Perfume song? Like, I'm just trying to...
Go.
Go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Last Stop... Last Stop Willoughby.
Last Stop Willoughby.
You know what? I'll dig out a cassette.
And you sounded like Nirvana. Let's. Like,
no.
Okay,
we wanted to sound like Nirvana. But we sounded like kind of like 90s.
So you were like, Last Stop Willoughby.
Well, I wasn't singing.
Okay.
You were the Chris Novoselic. You're the tall bass player dude.
Tall bass player, that's right, yeah.
I copied his, like, long bass strap. So I was,
everybody in the 90s.
Yes.
Yeah. Rain. Who had the longest bass strap in the 90s?
He might have been one of them.
There's somebody who was, like, famous for that, like, the low hang.
Now the young kids are
up here,
born in the early aughts.
Oh, yeah.
They're into 90s, like, and 80s production.
Is that good?
Yeah.
No more.
If we get this, too.
Oh, yeah.
What are these Skittles things?
We'll find out.
We just think they're weird, so we're buying them, but we don't actually know what they are.
I think they're hard candy. And, like,
you want
tropical.
You want one? We're going to open them.
Sure. I mean, yeah. I at least
you get the first one.
See them.
Yeah. Here you go. Oh, they're lollipops. Skittles lollipops.
I see.
Oh, you don't want a lollipop?
We should go to the Scientology Center and see if any of the people patrolling want a lollipop.
Yeah. Well, let's hang out with those guys. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Cool. This gives you a little bit of sticky mouth. It's very strong coffee. Wait a sec. Hold on.
Taking a few.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, hell yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cool. Take care.
You as well.
Cool.
The days. Skittles, lollipops.
Cheers, everybody.
Cheers.
Hell yeah. All right, let's continue on our way. We stopped at a place called Ginger Grass, which is a chain. Really there's Ginger good. Grass in Silver Lake as well. And we're here on... Yeah, just the big Scientology signs right there. We could join if we wanted to. There's a lot of good musicians who are Scientologists.
Just Beck. Who else?
Well, I think he's out.
He is out.
Chick Corea was.
Chick
was
Corea. Yeah. Herb Alpert.
No. Is Herb Alpert?
Oh, I always thought Herb Alpert, but maybe I'm thinking of Chick Corea because they're the same in my mind.
That's cigarette smells good.
Yeah. That's funny. That cigarette did smell good. Like, smoking is cool.
It's back.
Now, Joe, we were talking about you do a podcast.
Yes.
Interview. It used to be, it started out as you just interviewed drummers. And
yes.
It's called the Trap Set because that's what the technical name for a drum kit is. And the Trap Set is a great fucking podcast. And I've listened to, I think, every episode.
Wow, okay.
You had Phil Collins on.
I did, yeah.
One of the best drummers of the 70s and 80s, Phil Collins. Mm-hmm. How was that? Tell us about Phil Collins.
Phil Collins is really interesting to me because he is an example of this phenomenon that I find really exciting about music, where I didn't like him in the 80s when I was growing up because he was all over the pop radio.
Susudio.
Like, those weird Muppets.
I thought of him as mom music at the time.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And then later I started getting into his weirder stuff through the albums he played on with Brian Eno and then, obviously, Genesis.
Yeah.
But then I came fully around to his 80s pop stuff, and I think it's genius, too.
Yeah.
So I love everything that he's done. I even love, like, the Disney, the Tarzan score that he made and everything.
That's where I draw the line, but fair. Okay.
I love it all.
I draw the line at that song he made about, like, the homeless epidemic.
Oh, yeah, Another Day in Paradise.
She walks out with the hands on her feet.
It's a good song.
It's a good song, but it's just too...
You don't like the lyrics.
Oh,
I just don't like to think about not having a home.
Right.
And he really drills it home in a way that makes me feel sad.
But he's an interesting guy. You know, he was a child actor, which explains a lot. He was the Artful Dodger.
Right. Along with Davy Jones for the Monkees.
Maybe he was,
They were both the Artful Dodger.
They both were at different times. But yeah, he was on the West End from a young age.
And does that explain why he is almost devastatingly self-deprecating?
I don't know where that comes from, but
it's when British I went to his stuff, maybe
I got too. An email from him after I had done over 100 episodes of my show.
Yeah,
and he wanted to come on, and I was blown away. Like when I started the show,
he approached you, damn.
Sort of. I mean, I had emailed him, and I never thought I would hear back, and then he wrote back to me. And he's like, yeah, let's do it. I'm in Miami. And I flew to Miami.
I remember this, yeah.
And I went over to Phil Collins' house, which was amazing. and he was, I think he was kind of sick at the time. He was taking a nap when I got there. And then, you know, he was great at talking about his life. But he seemed kind of depressed. It kind of gave me Citizen Kane vibes. Like he talked about how he wanted to go to his childhood home. Every time I'm in London, I want to go to my childhood home and see if my drum kit is still up in the attic. I left one there from when I was a kid.
Oh no, Rosebud.
And he's got exactly. He's got and he had a recording studio, like a fancy recording studio in his house. And he's like, I've never gone in there. I just don't feel like I can write more songs. And if I do, I have to try to top what I've already done. And it's just too overwhelming.
He's in his head. Get out of your head, bro.
Yeah.
Just have fun.
He's so amazing.
But he's had a lot of physical health problems, his back.
Fuck up your mind, too.
And he was a workaholic for many years, and then when he tried to retire, that's when he became an alcoholic. He talks about that in his book, too, but...
Wow.
But anyway, I think he's great, and I think that he feels disappointed that he doesn't get the same respect in the artistic community
ridiculous.
Like Brian Eno does, but actually I think he kind of does at this point.
I remember him saying in your interview, maybe he said this in your interview, but he was like, look, I only wrote Susudio once.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was other stuff I did.
And it's a fair point from him, because Brian Eno is kind of untouchable, but he produces Coldplay albums too. I mean, it's not like he's only making weird ambient music all day long.
Yeah, he produced U2's biggest records and stuff.
Like,
but Phil Collins was so self-deprecating, I have to say, I was like, I wanted to be like, do you know who you are? Like, the 80s was like Michael Jackson, Madonna, Phil Collins.
Yeah, and I was talking to him about that, because a lot of those people, Whitney Houston, you know, a lot of the people that were that mega famous died. I don't think it's healthy. You know, I think I don't think he was expecting his weird breakup album to break through to the pop world in the way that it did, you know, when he first made it.
Which breakup album?
Value.
Genesis.
Yeah. No, his album, like his
Phil Collins.
It was his romantic breakup album, you know, where he was. I think he was getting out of a marriage or a long-term relationship.
What was the
That was the one that had In the Air Tonight and
Hits.
Yeah,
huge. So that's 1984. So that's like Thriller, In the Air Tonight, Miami Vice.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Don Johnson dating Barbara Streisand.
Oh, yeah. I actually worked with Don Johnson, too.
Whoa!
Because I was doing the music for the Kenan Thompson sitcom, and Don was in the cast, and I had to produce Don singing a Christmas song one day. He was so nice, and it was really fun.
I gotta say, I did a table read with him. And I sat next to him, and I was like, I'm sitting next to the fucking Johnson.
No, I was excited.
What the fuck? Amazing. I mean, I don't even think I watched Miami Vice, because I was too young for it as a kid, but I watched some of it mainly just for the cameos, like Leonard Cohen's in it and stuff, and like...
So weird.
It's such a weird, actually very good show. But yeah, Phil Collins, man, what an interesting guy. Yeah, I guess being a child actor is rough too, and
that kind of makes you a certain way. And yeah, I don't know. But
who are your favorite? I know you just had Questlove on, which is huge.
Yeah, I guess that was last year. But yeah, that was a great one. I don't really have all of them are my favorites, really. Like,
yeah, you can't single one out.
The opportunity to just engage in a real conversation with somebody for an hour is a gift, and I think it's something that we need to do that we don't get to do as much these days.
Speaking Definitely. Of, tell us more about your composing. You did some for Keenan's show.
Yeah.
Russian Doll.
I've been doing it for about 20 years. I'm from Milwaukee originally, and I was in Milwaukee in my early 20s, and some friends of mine had made a film called American Movie that became a Sundance hit.
Sure.
And got a cult following, and then I scored their subsequent few films.
And this is Chris Smith?
Chris Smith, and then also there was a woman named Sarah Price, and the first film I scored was also directed by a guy named Dan Ullman. And I did a few films with that crew of folks, and then started scoring Adult Swim shows in New York. By that time, I was in a band in New York, so...
Parts and Labor.
That's right,
That's where I first saw Parts and Labor... And saw you because I knew Dan.
Right.
And
Sarah Kay.
And Sarah Kay.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sarah Kay, the magical Sarah Kay, set us up as friends.
That's right.
She was like, you know, I think you'd like Joe Wong. And then I was like, okay, well, yeah, give me his number. He lives in LA. And then she was just right. She knows what the deal is with human beings.
Mm-hmm.
She's very good.
She's a very intuitive person.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's impressive you've been doing it for 20 years. I have a couple of friends who do it, and I know it's not easy.
It's not
to get the job. I mean,
yeah, you have it, I'm sure something like you can.
Yeah, that's what definitely.
And even once you're in it, there's no guarantee you keep going.
It's easy to do. Like when I watched Dune 2, I was beatboxing the whole time. But you can't get the job to get paid for it.
Yeah, I mean, even when I first moved to LA, I had done a few. I've probably done like 5 feature films, and I was on maybe my 3rd TV show. And I still had a hard time making ends meet for the first few years. And then when I was here, my friend Carrie, who I met when she was playing drums in a noise band that played with my band, Parts and Labor, when we were on tour in L.A., Carrie had started music supervising, and she was working on Master of None, or what became Master of None.
Mm-hmm.
And we were one of, like, 20 or... something composers that submitted for it, and Aziz just liked ours the best, so we ended up getting that gig.
Nice.
And then I thought, okay, now when the show became a hit, I thought, okay, now the jobs are gonna roll in, and
right.
It still took another year or so. But yeah, pretty much all of the jobs I've gotten can be traced back to playing in basements in like DIY punk bands in the 90s.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. And so you moved from Milwaukee where you were in bands or no?
I started playing in bands when I was in like a teenager, and then I started playing in clubs when I was about 14 and started touring when I was 17.
Mm-hmm.
And we were trying to model ourselves after bands like Fugazi, you know, very DIY, and there was a punk zine called Maximum Rock and Roll, and they had a mm-hmm. like a book called Book Your Own Fucking Life. It had telephone numbers that you could call for you know, DIY promoters in every city, and so we would rely on that.
Is that the Black Flag book?
It was kind of like that. And then you would call people and set up basement shows in various towns, or you would know other bands. Like we started by just asking the older bands from our town where they would play in each city and get phone numbers that way. And and then we started touring while we were on like high school break and stuff like that.
Nice.
So I started there, and then ended up moving to the East Coast for a while, and then came out here.
Well, you moved to DC first.
I moved to
really into the whole Fugazi thing.
Well, I played in a band with some folks that were on Discord Records, which was Fugazi's the label that was run by one of the members of Fugazi.
And was that Mary Timoney?
No, that was a guy called Devin Ocampo, who was in bands called Farrakhet and Medications. And he briefly dated Mary and worked with her on an album. And then he also had another band that was on tour, so Mary needed a drummer, and he recommended me. And so that's how I started working with Mary, and that was about over 20 years ago. And the two of us just did a tour as a duo. We were opening for the band Spoon at the time. We were just traveling.
You did?
We were going across the country in her Subaru Outback, all through U.S. and Canada. And then we became very close friends, and I would say she's like a sister to me now.
Whoa, yeah, she's cool as shit. Wait, you opened for Spoon? Were you at my party when the Spoon dude showed up?
I don't know. What party?
It was at my house. It was like a house party, and I was like, oh, wow, here comes the part of the night. I was very proud of the party because, like, people,
it got to the critical mass for celebrities that you didn't know.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh, it got to the psycho, like, who the fuck are these people? And people were like picking fruit off our trees and throwing it and stuff. And I was like, this fucking rules.
Was that at your current house? Or
it was at my current house. Oh, yeah.
I don't remember that. He's friends with John Vanderslice, so that's probably why he came.
There you go. He's friends with John Vanderslice. Shout out to John Vanderslice. And then, and Joe, so you've played with people from Fugazi. Brendan Canty, or did he do the podcast?
Brendan was the first person that did the podcast.
Right, yes, okay.
And that's because I was on tour with another artist called Marnie Stern.
Yes.
She's a guitar shredder, and she's one of the most unique, wild folks I've ever met. And she's friends with Fred Armisen and later went on to become the guitar player of the Seth Meyers Show for a long time. But we got invited when Fred was still on SNL to a taping after our tour. And I was really depressed because I wasn't enjoying touring anymore. And I thought maybe I was in a loveless marriage with music after dedicating myself to it for many years.
Oh, man.
And I ran into Brendan. He was also at the taping because he's also friends with Fred. Fred loves drummers, so he knows a lot of them. And I actually met Fred originally when he was the drummer of a band called Trench Mouth in Chicago.
Yes.
I was asking Brendan for all this advice, and he gave me really good advice. And then I decided that that would make for a good podcast, kind of similar to what Marin did in the early years of his podcast, where he was just trying to basically work through his neuroses and his perceived like career shortcomings with his friends or other comics. So that was how the podcast started.
Right. And so, okay. So that,
am I selling it?
That kind of, no, it's a great podcast. Well, I think that's why I like podcasts, is like you get to know people. That's why I like Turn Out a Punk too. Damian Abraham like does a great job just starting with music, but getting into people's lives. And that's what you do with
Damian knew about like a high school band I had that put out one 7-inch that I played bass in that I completely forgot about. He's like an encyclopedia.
He's like a John Worster kind of, mm-hmm. like the dude knows everything. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say is, I think there's a larger theme. It's just interesting because drummers are interesting and different people.
Yeah, I think it's like
why are they
gold.
Different? What is the thing that makes somebody want to be like a rock drummer? And why is it like you're a person that you have so much like other shit you're doing? Like you're a writer and a music writer. You're a composer, writer, and put together gigantic orchestral things. It's like
safe to assume you play many instruments.
Yeah,
so you're very much not just a drummer. Like you're a multi-instrumentalist producer, kind of also. And so, what about drummers? Since you kind of do both things, what is it about drummers?
What's I can only speak to like what it represents for me when I'm playing different roles. But I think drummers are people that can make art in a slightly less vulnerable way than, say, singers. Like, you literally have an apparatus in front of you as a drummer. You're kind of protected.
Right.
And you can speak through that instrument. And there's also an athletic component to it. So I think...
Definitely.
You know, drummers care more about being like virtuosic than some other instrumentalists do. And it's cooler. Like a drummer showing off, even if it's gratuitous, is sort of cooler than a guitar player showing off for some reason.
For sure.
It just looks cooler.
Yeah. It's way more fun. My Instagram, if I just go to the search button to like look up one of your names, all of the suggestions are going to be like drumming videos. I do watch a lot of them. They're fun.
But the other thing that's really cool about drumming is that, like, then once you get past that kind of virtuosic thing, the great drummers can make their presence known without doing anything flashy. Like, all the, you know, if you go back to one of my favorite eras, which is like the hard bop or post-bop era of the 50s through the 60s in jazz, like just the way that the drummer plays the ride cymbal beat, you can tell who it is. You can tell the difference between Elvin Jones or Roy Haynes or Art Blakey, even if they all sat down at the same exact drum set and played the same pattern. You can hear it. And that's awesome too. But as far as like the psychology of it, I think it's a way of being artistic but obscuring the self a little bit.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Like Clyde Stubblefield.
Mm-hmm.
Did you ever?
He was extremely self-deprecating. I mean, talk about self-deprecating. Yes, he passed away maybe 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay.
But he actually lived for several decades until the end of his life in Madison, Wisconsin. So growing up in Milwaukee, I used to go drive out and see him play.
Whoa.
And he would just play Monday nights in a tiny bar. And sometimes nobody would go.
Whoa, this is James Brown's drummer who invented...
The funky drummer.
Kind of invented funk and then hip-hop.
I mean,
his
beat from The Funky Drummer is one of the most sampled, if not the most sampled, beats of all time.
Yeah, so and that's somebody who created and is a creative... Like, his force is, like, equal to James Brown in a certain way.
But if you were to ask him how he did what he did, he would just say, I don't know, you know, I can't even tell you. It just came to me.
Right.
And the thing with him is he's kind of the opposite of James Brown personality-wise. Like, he was not... at least in my interactions with him, he was not a super confident guy. He was pretty self-deprecating and gentle and kind of quiet.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, for better or worse, I think people like that paired with somebody like James Brown, who projects endless confidence, which is well justified in his case, that's the ultimate pairing, but often people like Clyde get screwed over in the end. And so, like, I think he told me that he hated that song, Funky Drummer, because he got paid something like a $40 session fee and then got no revenue from it for the rest of its existence.
Was that like...
And I think he was on... I think the story was that they were on tour and he was relaxing in his hotel room and James Brown called him and said, get to the studio, we're going to make a song. And he didn't want to.
James Brown, notoriously cool dude. And he didn't want to.
And he didn't feel like it. He was like sleeping, you know?
Yeah.
And so then he showed up, did it begrudgingly, and made history, and then didn't reap any of the financial rewards in the
end.
That's
insane.
Right. Well, James Brown was probably really cool about paying his musicians and stuff. Respectful.
Well, it's interesting, though, because then on the same day I interviewed the other drummer for James Brown during that era, because they had two drummers on stage, Jabbo Starks. And Jabbo was so much more confident and didn't let... At least by his own account, he didn't let James Brown fuck with him in that way. James Brown would levy fines on the players if they made a mistake.
Yeah.
He would like put his hand up and like $5 or $10 they would have to pay if they made a mistake. And Jabbo would just be like, yeah, I'm not doing that. Fuck you. And then James Brown respected him for it.
Right.
So, and Clyde, I don't...
I gotta play my little game. You're not gonna play my little game.
Clyde didn't have... I don't think he had the wherewithal to resist the
right
the charismatic power of Clyde Stubble or of James Brown.
Yeah, James Brown, man. There's a documentary about him, and his daughters are brought out to kind of be like, you know, look, he was a bad guy, but we own his legacy, and we really want people. They were kind of, they were doing a little James washing. But that's so crazy. Like, who, yeah, is there, is Neil Peart a great drummer? Because this is like, when we talk about great drummers, the drummer from Rush, songwriter and drummer, and
He's the lyricist, yeah.
Yeah, he's an Ayn Rand lyricist. I love the band Rush.
He's since kind of disavowed Ayn Rand, too, like, later in his life. Or he said, you know, I don't want to be associated with the movements that have sprung up
right.
because of her writing.
He was like, look, I read this book when I was 18, and it really affected me just like everyone else, and I don't want to be associated with this crazy bitch.
One of my faves is Stephen Perkins from Jane's Addiction.
Oh, my God. He's on my show, too, yep.
Where would you rank him in the pantheon?
I don't really quantify it that way.
What's your top three?
No, but you think he's a great
guy. Here's how I can quantify it, or here's how I'd ask, is I would say, like, who have I spent the most time listening to?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I think number one would be Elvin Jones, who played with Coltrane most famously in
Love Supreme.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And I still get my mind blown by him, because they just released this Live at the Village Gate record. The Village Gate was a club in Greenwich Village, which is now Le Poisson Rouge. And it's like a basement club. And Coltrane played there with Eric Dolphy in the 60s. And some guy that was engineering, you know, the front of house engineer or whatever, happened to have bought a microphone and was testing it out that night. And he captured the band with a single microphone. And they just unearthed it like last year or a couple years ago and put it out. And it's still one of the greatest things I've ever heard.
Wow. I gotta check that out.
Yeah, I mean, the level of ESP that they had, you just don't hear that at all anymore. I mean, it's just, I don't think you can achieve that with smartphones in existence anymore.
Right. Interesting.
Now, when you have a Stephen Perkins on, do you geek out a little, or are you able to hold it together?
I think I'm usually able to hold it together, but you listen and
like
let me know.
Inside. No, like in your own head.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely been times where I was like looking at someone's face and I had a little starstruck moment.
Yeah.
Like one of the early ones was Bernard Purdy, who's a famous session drummer. He played with everybody from Aretha Franklin to Steely Dan. But he's got a larger than life personality. He's also one of the most sampled drummers of all time. Oh, one of the most recorded drummers of all time.
Is he like a studio rat?
He was a New York guy, yeah.
Okay.
But he's just one of the greats, in my opinion.
Nice.
And, and then when I was talking to Phil Collins, we were face-to-face, and I was like, I recognize that face from somewhere, and it's like, yeah, it's on all of his album covers. So that was kind of surreal. The great thing is that most drummers that I've spoken to are very, very humble.
Right.
And once I started branching out to other musicians, especially some that are famous, it made me realize that drummers tend to be more humble, you know?
Right. Bassists and drummers, the rhythm section, maybe they're humble.
I think singers kind of need to be
bravado,
more confident. They need to believe
in
their own
art. Yeah, it's kind of like being a cult leader. Well, you have to believe in your own divinity or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And some of them kind of are cult leaders, back to Polyphonic Spree.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Perry Farrell.
Oh, is he a culty guy? I don't know.
I would have joined his cult in 1987.
Yeah. The cult of being sad and doing heroin all the time.
So, John, when you were playing in Perfume, did you have, like, ambitions of becoming a professional musician?
Not in the slightest. I was working full-time at the WB Network, and this friend of mine, Max Ween, I mentioned, he did, and he was very good at his... He played guitar and sang, and he was a good musician. Probably still is. We just haven't played in 30 years. For me, it was just fun.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I didn't really contribute anything other than playing bass. Like, I memorized the songs.
Right.
Like, I wasn't a musician like, oh, what if we did this? I was like, oh, you want, okay, so I do this here and this here, and that was it.
He's dictating your bass lines.
By necessity, not out of micromanaging,
Right, just, right.
So I enjoyed playing on stage, and it was fun, and again...
I think it would also be liberating if you didn't have any ambition weighing you down, you know?
No, for me, it's like, oh, we're playing the Dragonfly? Huge. Like, this is the pinnacle of our career.
Yeah. So what were you doing at the WB Network?
I was in marketing, and eventually was writing promos for the WB shows.
What shows were they?
Well, in those days, it would have been Dawson's Creek, Buffy, Felicity... A lot of good shows.
Buffy?
Buffy
all right.
The Vampire Slayer.
People love Buffy.
I like that show.
It was good.
I remember I lived with somebody that loved it, but I could never get into it for whatever reason.
Was that when you were living with Adrian?
That was when I was living with Adrian Grenier and from Entourage, yes. Nice guy who I saw at Ostrich Farm. The restaurant here in L.A. quite recently, and I pussied out when it comes to seeing him.
Really?
I shouldn't have, because but I just assume that he's... I don't know. I should. Sorry I didn't say hi, Adrian. Next time I will approach you and be like, you remember when I lived with you for a year and I was really...
Buffy all the time?
I smelled really bad, but I didn't know it because I was blind to my own smell.
Well, nothing's changed.
Yeah, that's true. I am a stinky guy. We drank a lot of 40s. That was the thing. Yeah. A lot of
40s. That'll make you stink.
Joe, now that we've walked up to this precipice, I will say there is some similarities between my musical prowess and my podcast dreams. Like, I did not set out to do... I'm not a performer. I did not set out to be a podcaster. I'm like, oh, this will be fun. You know, it was a dumb joke between Daly and I at a party. And I really thought, oh, we'll probably do like 3 or 4 of them and it'll go away. But people seem to like it and I'll do it. But I am like fighting John on... He wants to involve cameras in this podcast. And I just like...
Well, I've made it clear we're involving cameras, but you'll never be shown.
He's made it clear.
You'll be on a filter with like a...
A chicken face.
A funny face, yeah.
But yes, so it's kind of the same way, like, oh, this will be fun to do, and dare I say silly. You know, I didn't think the band was silly, but it was like, oh, this will be fun, and if we can play some gigs, we'll play some gigs. If we can get some, you know, have some fun on this podcast, we'll do it.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is you're going to quit your other job and go for it.
You're going to quit Bob's Burgers and dedicate your life to Two Johns. The video podcast.
Probably not. Probably not.
Damn it.
That said, I will happily sign over my 50% of the empire to another John.
Yeah.
If you want to.
It'll be like Zorro where you pass the role down to other Johns.
I don't want to be an albatross around Daly's neck.
No, you're no albatross.
I think you guys should try to keep this going until you both retire and pass it on to other Johns.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got to find Johns and with driver's licenses, obviously.
But they should be like really, like they should be like 20 and like really like show them the ropes. Have them sit in the back seat quietly for like 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, yeah. We need interns to really just sit here and learn. That we can abuse. No, but in like positive ways. Like
like cleaning up
the constructive
pranks. Mm-hmm. Yeah, like doing pranks with us and stuff. So Joe, we ask every guest this, what is your favorite drive in LA?
I like driving down Sunset. Driving west on Sunset.
That's fun.
Yeah.
Now, is this a jogger or someone in distress?
It's a jogger.
Oh, that's a jogger, but her arms make it look like she's in distress.
And, when you're running downhill, you're supposed to kind of do floppy arms like that to keep your balance.
Gotcha.
Is that right?
I once did a marathon that was basically all down a mountain. It's the Big Bear Marathon. So,
really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's down that road?
Yeah, it's down from the Big Bear down to San Bernardino.
Wow, that's impressive.
Yeah.
And so it's floppy arm city.
So it's easy on your, it's easier on your lungs and heart than doing a regular marathon, but it took my legs like a month to recover after doing that.
What does that mean? So you're like having knee problems and shit?
Just the muscles in your legs have to work, like the front of your legs have to work
much
harder. Yeah, because you're going basically downhill the whole time.
Yeah. And how long do you... I remember you were like, I'm like sober. How long do you take to, does it take to train for one of those?
Well, that year I did 3 marathons, so I was just basically running all year, but,
what the fuck?
It was like
3
COVID.
Marathons?
It was during COVID.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Did you wear a mask for them?
No, no.
Because you don't believe in COVID, right?
Well, I was vaccinated and it was outside.
Okay.
Yeah, so I haven't tried the indoor marathon yet, but,
it's a treadmill
in your face
thing.
Daily.
Yeah, exactly.
But,
fuck me.
But, yeah, people do that. So the first one took like 18, I think maybe I took 18 weeks to train for it. I used this program called the Hal Higdon Marathon Program. He's a famous marathon guru, and you can just download it, and print it out. And it's very simple. It's just 4 days a week, and it tells you how many miles to run each day. And I'm not a, like, naturally marathon running person. So
right.
No one is. It is against nature for the human body.
Thank you, John.
Well, but some people are just... I'm not, like, very skinny, you know? Some people just are carrying less weight. You know, I don't have that really skinny build that a lot of the marathon runners have.
Well, I was watching Naiad last night. You know Naiad? Diana Naiad?
No.
There's a movie about her called Naiad. It's not good, but okay. She is a person that swam. Like, she does marathon swimming. Mm. So it takes 2.5 days... She swims for 2.5 days from Cuba to Florida and gets, like, stung by box jellyfish, and she's all fucked up.
And boats are following her
There's a follow boat that's, like, right next to her pretty much the whole time. But she's still, like, susceptible to sharks and jellyfish, and she gets stung and bitten. And
it seems like the follow boat could have had a net out to catch some of those jellyfish.
Well, the first time she tried the Florida-Cuba, she knew there was dangerous stuff in the waters, so she swam within a cage that was attached to the boat. But then she realized, though, that's cheating. I've got to be, you know, face the elements that I'm actually facing.
Disagree. The swimming is impressive enough, but good for her.
Yeah, she's got to do her thing the way she does it, Nyad.
That's right. That's right. I'm not in charge.
We got to get Annette Bening an Oscar for that shit. Oh, man.
But I think I cut you off. I know I cut you off, Joe, and I apologize. Which part of Sunset West do you like?
Like driving from downtown all the way to...
The water?
To Santa Monica.
Oh, yeah. that's a good one.
Beautiful. I would do that before I lived in L.A.
Yeah.
And before you live here...
This is curving, by the way. I'm not turning right.
You don't recognize the system that most people that live in L.A. live by, which is you stay in your neighborhood most of the time.
Right.
And I would, like, schedule meetings all around town in the same day before I lived here, and I would drive. I just love that drive.
It is a great one.
You drive by the Source restaurant. You drive by Book Soup, the Comedy Store, all these legendary places in Hollywood on the Strip.
You get to see the Strip.
Yeah.
The Source is now Pink Taco, I believe. Very
That's
crass.
That's right.
Very crass.
Yeah, and then you drive through...
Is that Jonah Ray?
No. No. Those are some cool dudes, though.
I thought that was my friend Megan at first.
We all thought they were someone.
Jonah Ray's a drummer.
Yes, he is.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think of Lars Ulrich? Metallica.
I haven't had him on my show yet.
You gotta have him on.
I know. I hung out with him at the Gold Line, in Highland Park once.
Wow.
And
he likes to party.
He was super nice.
Yeah.
And I think he's a good drummer. I think his strength is that he's a good arranger, and the parts that he comes up with are really good.
Right.
People love to dog him for a number of reasons, but I don't think it's fair.
I don't think it's fair because he's amazing.
Yeah.
As a non-musician, I enjoy watching him just because he does have some flair. He's no Stephen Perkins, but he gives you a show.
I had Dave Lombardo on my show, which of the thrash metal guys, he's more recognized as being a great. But I think both of them are great. And Lars was a part of a lot of great recordings, seminal recordings, really.
Mm-hmm. Well, Slayer's a different thing.
Yeah.
That's Slayer, right?
Yes.
Dave Lombardo.
Yeah, Dave Lombardo is Slayer. But those are all thought of as, you know, contemporaries, thrash metal contemporaries.
Right, right. But Metallica's, like, also pop. Like, mm-hmm. even, like, that song, One, like, the fucking drums on that.
Mm-hmm.
Can't mess with that shit.
It's great. It's a great part.
So he's like more of a writer.
That's how I think of him.
Because he fucks up live, and that's why people don't like him, right?
Maybe. I don't know. I think, again, it's a... Metal is a particularly athletic art form, and so a lot of people focus on the athleticism and forget about the artistic side of it. But
right.
But Lars is great. Yeah. I mean, it's the same thing with the way people make fun of Ringo. And the truth is, if you put somebody like Neil Peart in the Beatles, it would suck. So Ringo is the perfect drummer for that band.
So you're saying it would suck to have like a guy with like 19 rototoms and a fucking like
playing on Hey Jude. Yes, exactly.
Playing on Hey Jude and like going, that's crazy to me. Yeah, people dog Ringo, but I think it's because he was like goofy. Like if he was like really hot.
Like Paul?
It'd be a different deal. Like, yeah, if he was cute like Paul or like the
brooding,
dark.
Brooding like Lennon, right?
Yeah, brooding and, or brooding like George, right? Or
I think John was just kind of brooding.
Was John brooding?
Kind of.
John's brooding. George is brooding. Ringo's like, I'm a goofy guy. I've got to photograph. boop, beep, boop, beep, boop. I'm a... Octopus's garden in the sea. So he's a great drummer. Could you get him? What's going on? Are you trying to get him or what?
I have talked to his right-hand man, and they said he wanted to do it. I have to follow up. We were very close before COVID, and then I've been remiss following up.
Since. I just want to be friends with Ringo. It seems like he's got the coolest circle.
Well, the guy that one of the guys that played on my album is a guy called Jim Keltner, and he's one of the all-time great studio drummers. In fact, he played with all of the Beatles besides Paul on their solo records.
Whoa! And is he the guy that did the Thriller beats?
No, Jim was on. He was in the Traveling Wilburys.
Okay.
And you know, he played with Bob Dylan famously, but he's been on thousands of recordings, and he's one of the coolest. If not the coolest people I've ever met.
Really?
And he and Ringo are really good friends, so maybe I should ask through Jim.
Yeah.
Damn, we got to get you Ringo.
Get her done.
And then you'll get invited to that Capitol Records birthday thing, where it's like, it's Ringo's birthday. And
Joe Walsh is here, yeah.
Joe Walsh is like all his buddies. Yeah. Mike Love.
Armisen gets invited to that thing now.
Oh,
Armisen,
man.
Yeah.
I'm so jealous. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's Ringo's birthday. Fred.
Well, Joe, we're close to home. Thank you very much for doing our
podcast.
Thanks
for having me.
Yeah, dude. Thanks for being on.
I feel like an interloper as a non-funny person.
You're fucking great. Joe Wong, the album is Mere Survival. Also a great album, Night Creatures. And it's Joe Wong and the Night Creatures who plays live. And you should go see them when they come to your town.
Anything else you'd like to plug?
Yeah, anything you want
to
plug?
You want to say hi to Harry Walliner?
Hi, Harry. Is Harry the editor?
No, he's just our fan.
He's our fan. He's our main fan. We also have Jason Mantzoukas. We have...
Jason's a drummer, too.
Jason's a great drummer. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
What can he do?
Jason and I met through our friend John Kolpitz, a.k.a. Kid Millions of the band Oneida.
Oh, right.
And Jason and I met when I first moved here, too. And we talk about drums whenever we get together.
That rules.
Fun.
Shout out to my dumb brother, Fat Daly. And that's it. Two Johns Don't Make a Right, guys. Woo!